Well, I'm feeling really quite encouraged after the church weekend away. Normally when we go on our church weekend away, I sleep terribly and you long for your own bed again. But I've just had the best 2 nights sleep I've had for a number of weeks. So I'm feeling reasonably buoyant actually and really quite happy for our weekend away. If you weren't there, as James said earlier on, please don't feel any sense at all you've missed out. Hopefully very soon you better get on the website and listen to the talks. They were really, really fantastic. They were invigorating. They were marked by clarity, but also a real passion with Lee McMahon, who spoke to us from the book of Philippians. And also, you know, those that weren't there, then I encourage folks who were there this morning to, you know, talk to you and encourage you with what they've been learning and growing in over the weekend as well. One of the key things about our annual church weekend away is using it as our annual general meeting as a church. So whilst we've been away, each session we've had one or two people who lead a ministry of Christ Church Central sharing and telling us how things have gone over the past year, things to be thankful for, things that we've learned from, and then looking ahead to the year or two ahead and giving us some vision and a pathway ahead for the future as well. Basically what we're going to be doing this evening is I'm sharing with you the minister's report. We've moved that out of the weekend away. We cancelled one of the sessions at the weekend away. It gave us a little bit more time and a bit more freedom, a little bit less pressure. And we put this into the evening, and that's really great because there are some folks here and it means you don't miss out on this. Our text for the year is Romans chapter 1 and verse 16. And back in September, for the academic year, we were handing out these church calendars, giving details, the broad brushstroke of what's happening over the year ahead, so we can plan accordingly and pray. And on the top of it, it's got Romans 1 verse 16 there. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. So tonight, what I want to do is preach that little verse and just show the implications for us as a church and how that verse pans out for us very practically in the year ahead. Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Use that word, ashamed. Shame. Shame is, if we've ever felt it, quite a painful emotion. It can be caused by a consciousness of guilt. We feel shame because we really are guilty of something or other. Or we can feel a sense of shame because of a personal shortcoming that we're culpable for. Or we can feel shame because of a real failure for which we know we are culpable and responsible. And we might call these things well-placed shame. Okay? There's a shame. There's a sense of being ashamed, but we ought to be ashamed of ourselves. Well-placed shame. But there is also such a thing as misplaced shame. When we feel shame for something that is not even bad. We're just ashamed of it. Ashamed like of Jesus, like of his gospel. Paul obviously battled with this. I think that's why he picks it up. He says he's not ashamed. Well, it must come from somewhere for him to actually write that. I think it's probably highly likely to be something that he struggled with himself. He battled with it himself. Paul was tempted to be ashamed of the gospel. Well, I mean, it's understandable when we just simply take a few moments to think of the context that Paul lived and shared the gospel in. He was a Christian leader. To claim in the Roman world that an unknown Jew from some obscure backwater of the empire who had been crucified, and here I open brackets in a very long sentence, crucified, there was no way of being more humiliated, there was no way of being more conquered there was no way of being more defeated in the Roman world than be crucified. Yeah, but to be crucified really meant you were crushed by Rome. That was it for you. You couldn't be more conquered by Rome than to be crucified. End of brackets. This unknown Jew from this backwater crucified to claim that he's Lord? That's the way this letter begins, isn't it? That's what we've looked back at. We've spent some time in this letter already. Paul writes to Rome, the capital, and he says there at the end of verse 4 that Jesus Christ is Lord. He's not Caesar. This Jesus is Lord. To claim that in that context, that his crucified unknown Jew was Lord, you're going to be tempted at points to keep your mouth shut, aren't you? And of course, we're tempted to be ashamed of the gospel in our own context. So, I mean, I've just been thinking just through things that I think are true in our world, but they actually touch my own heart. So, in my own experience with friendships over the years, as a student in working in the motor industry, I spent a short time as well working in the brewing industry, Allied Breweries. Just thinking about neighbours and friends, to claim in our hedonistic culture that the only way to be drunk is drunk in the spirit, they think you're nuts, don't they? Really, the only way of being drunk is drunk in the spirit of God. Wait. Try saying that on West Street on a Friday night. To claim in our multi-ethical society that lifelong heterosexual monogamy is the only place for sex. You're laughed out of court, aren't you? From all sorts of angles for living that. To claim in our multi-religious environment that Jesus is the only way of salvation. I mean, that's scandalous, isn't it? I mean, that's thought of. Some people would even think that's immoral. You can't say that. So, like Paul, we know and we have experienced surely the feelings of being ashamed of the gospel. But there's probably another lurking temptation. It's not just the subjective emotion of feeling deep embarrassment. I think Paul is talking as well about objective shame, which I think we can sense and fear ourselves, the sense of public disgrace of being proved wrong. Now, what if the gospel isn't true? So in our minds, we can miss the big picture of what we know to be true. We can lose sight of the fact of Jesus' resurrection from the dead and end up fearing the gospel might just not be true. We take our eyes off the ball. I mean, I always say I've done Christianity Explored to talk about three men walking down the wall, fact, faith and feelings. And as they walk down the wall, faith must keep his eye on fact. And if he turns around and starts looking at feelings, he'll start wobble. You've got to keep your eye on the facts. And the facts are Jesus did rise from the dead. It's historically proven. I mean, all the evidence is there. But we lose that. And we go, I start looking at my feelings. Is it really true? And we wobble. Well, perhaps I may come a day when I'm proved wrong and a sense of public shame. What will my friends think of me? I think I'm an idiot. And so Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. Why not? Well, two things. First of all, the gospel is God's power to rescue. Look at verse 16. For it is the power of God for salvation. The gospel is a message. It is words. It is news. It is good news. It is information about God's work of rescue. But it's not just a word about God's work and what God's done in terms of rescue. It is actually about God's power. And it's not just about God's power to rescue. The information, the words themselves, come with God's power. The gospel is powerful. The message is powerful. evangelism, speaking about Jesus, gospeling about Jesus' life and death and resurrection, in one sense, is words. But it is not only words. It is, this is a phrase I've not heard for a while, but it was all the big thing around in the 80s, power evangelism. People used to say, well, we need to be doing power evangelism. And so they wondered, you know, people was a heart for all sorts of other stuff to be going on, as, you know, healings and various other things to sort of back up the gospel. Well, in actual fact, what Paul is saying here is the gospel, just the spoken word, never mind anything else, is itself power evangelism. The Greek word for power here is dynamis. That's the word from which we get dynamite. Dynamite. So let me illustrate. The Bible is very clear that it is humanly impossible to respond to the gospel in obedience of faith. That's the phrase that's looked. Look at verse 5. It talks about a faith being an act of obedience. We must obey God's way of salvation, like Noah did. Noah was warned there's going to be a flood. And what did he do? He trusted that what God said was true, and he relied on God's way of salvation. He obeyed. That is, he started building the ark. That's what God told him to do. Similar with a Passover. God told the Israelites that the firstborn of Egypt were going to die, and they had to obey God's way of salvation. And the only way for us to be saved is by obeying God's way of salvation in the gospel. And the Bible's absolutely clear that it is impossible for us to have that obedience of faith. But here's the point of this verse. The very utterance of the gospel word from God, God's word, implies and guarantees the power of God to make that obedience of faith possible. This is something that I was talking about with the guys in our new men's ministry yesterday afternoon. The gospel comes with the transforming, converting, regenerating power of God. It's so well illustrated by Jesus' healings. Jesus healed people by words. He said things, and the result was a healing. So let me illustrate, I don't have to turn to it, Matthew chapter 12. The healing of a man with a withered hand. The one thing that man with a withered hand could not do was move his hand. And that was the one thing that Jesus commanded him to do. Stretch out your hand. So Jesus commands him to do the one thing he can't do. Stretch out his hand. And the man responds in obedience. Jesus says, stretch out your hand. So he does the one thing that humanly he cannot do. Stretches out his hand. So the word comes with the power of God to enable the response, the obedience of faith. Similarly, in raising the dead, Jesus commanded the dead to do the impossible. And in each case, they obeyed the word. So Lazarus is in the tomb, and Jesus commands him, and that's the actual phrase that's used, commands him, come out. Well, he can't, he's dead. How does a dead person respond to a word? Because the word comes with the power of God. That's the gospel. The nature of the gospel is not just words. It comes with the power of God to bring about rescue, to bring about salvation. That's precisely what this verse says. So the word, the gospel of God, is like the voice of someone saying to a blind man in a dark room, read this. And at the same time as saying, read this, turning on the light and giving them sight at the same time. So that they're straight away, they're able to read and understand and obey the command that you've given to them. Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power, the dynamite of God for salvation. So when it comes to us sharing the good news about Jesus, we speak seemingly powerless words about Jesus. David earlier on mentioned going to Billy Graham, American evangelist. And I've been and heard Billy Graham on a number of occasions. And every time I've been, I kind of think, wasn't much there, was there? And did he say that? I mean, he came to Bramall Lane back in 1985. And I remember Tanya and I came down from that. We came from Bradford on the coach. Coachload came. And I remember thinking, not much there, really. Where's the zing? And at the end of it, he says, "Look, if you want to respond, then stand up. The coaches will wait. Come down." And hundreds of people. And I think, it doesn't sound or seem, but it is effective in the heart to bring about conversion. To bring about that transformation and that change. Paul is not ashamed of the gospel because he knows it is the power of God for salvation, and we should not be ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for salvation. Why else is Paul not ashamed of the gospel? Secondly, same sentence, but we'll go on and add one, two extra things. The gospel is God's power to rescue all who come empty-handed. Well, verse 18 says, isn't it? "For it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes." That is, simply trusts, does nothing. Trusts God to do absolutely everything. Comes, receives, empty-handed. That's faith, that's belief. To the Jew first, and also to the Greek. To underline, it is for everyone. It's for the Jew, it's for the Greek. It's for everybody. We may fear or worry that the gospel will be irrelevant. Now, irrelevant because, just got to start thinking about some of our friends and some of our neighbours and some of our members of our family, our loved ones. And we might think, well, the gospel's going to be, he's irrelevant to them. And maybe they've even told us it's irrelevant to them. It might be irrelevant to them because materially they're well off. Therefore, they see no need for God. It might well be that it's irrelevant to them because they are morally upright already. So they see no need to be rescued. It may well be that they are spiritually committed elsewhere. Therefore, they found the solutions to the answers of their questions, of their spiritual hunger. Therefore, Christianity is irrelevant to them. It may well be that they've made lifestyle choices. God would only get in the way of my life and my lifestyle. I've actually chosen to live this way and not the Jesus way. It may well be that they've made a religious decision already and chosen to reject Christianity and to be an atheist. It may well be there's just simple personal disposition, not bothered. Probably the most common one we come across, isn't it? It's irrelevant to me. I'm really just not bothered. But the gospel is God's power to rescue all, everybody. The gospel is God's power to, if I can put it this way, if it's for those who believe, it's for those who come empty-handed. Well, the materially well-off, the morally upright, the spiritually committed, those who've made lifestyle choices, those who've made religious decisions already, those who are just not bothered. The gospel is the power of God to empty their hands of what it is they think they have got that makes Christianity irrelevant. So they cannot do anything else but come empty-handed. We've been hearing over the weekend, all that I've gained, Paul says in Philippians 3, I count as loss. That's what the power of the gospel will do. Empty people's hands of what they think they've got, so they see it's rubbish for what it is, materially, morally, spiritually, religiously, that they aren't well off at all, and they need to come home. The gospel is God's power to rescue all. Whatever religion, whatever race, whatever colour, whatever class, whatever intellect, the moral, the immoral, the good, the bad, the atheist, the religious, and if you want proof, we want proof. The guy wrote this letter, Paul. He was completely shy. He was an enemy of Christian things. Went around persecuting the church. God completely transformed him. That's exhibit one. I'm going to give you a number of exhibits now. Exhibit one, Paul. Exhibit two, you, if you're already a Christian. Exhibit three, the person sat next to you, if they're already a believer. God's already done a miracle in you and the person sat right next to you. We think about the materially well off. And well, they will have no need for God. Well, Our news last week, and I've got to apologise to Andy H. again. What I said last week was, come on Wednesday, we've got some great news, and Andy's not dispositioned to being emotionally excited and everything's come along, and it's the kind of news that would make Andy do cartwheels. Well, a lot of people went away thinking that his wife Helen was pregnant. I didn't say that. I went nowhere near that. It was Mark's news about the wonderful gift we've been given as a church. That we've been facing a financial deficit. And a few years back, a loving, generous couple gave £100,000, which was added to £115,000 that members of Christchurch Forward raised to buy the house that the minister of this church lives in. It happens to be me at this point in time, so we have a minister in the city centre. This couple gave £100,000 and gave £100,000 interest-free loan. Well, they didn't know that we were struggling financially. And last week he turns up and says he doesn't want the cheque for £10,000. He's going to give that back. And by the way, he's going to write off the rest of the loan. And we say they're materially well off. So, you know, I remember their conversion. Very wealthy people coming to know Christ. What about the materially well-off people you know? You think they're too high? I know, I can introduce you to some folks who've had their hearts transformed by Christ. And they're still well-off. And they're proving that they know Christ and the gospel in their generosity to us. And we've been the benefits. Isn't that fabulous? £60,000 written off. Wow. The morally upright. See no need to be rescued. Well, I mean, just... Go to anyone in the room for this, actually. I would write myself down as exhibit 5, 4 or 5, whatever we got to. My wife, Tanya. Tanya went to chapel, to church regularly all the way through her life, and then came to the point and realised that actual fact she needed to be rescued. Spiritually committed elsewhere. I mean, we all heard, didn't we, Asif Mal coming and preaching and sharing with us just those few weeks ago, and he does that television programme to Muslims. And Muslims coming to faith there, live, on live telly. People who are spiritually committed elsewhere, so it's saying, well, no, I realise that the gospel's true. And we worry that people we know are already committed and got the answers elsewhere. That's too much of it. No, it's the gospel of God is the power of salvation to all. Those who've already got a commitment elsewhere. Those who might say the personal disposition of not being bothered. I found what David said quite striking earlier on. He'd come across Christian things in the past in his life, but never really come across people who spoke about a relationship with God. And when he started coming across them, he realized that in actual fact there was something to be bothered about. There was a sense of separateness you used. Suddenly you realise, well, actually, there's something I've not got. Yeah, until then, were you that bothered until then? Not really. And we worry about, the gospel of God can do that work in us and for us and through us. I don't know, we got about exhibit 8 or 9 there. I just wanted to press home the point. The gospel does transform us. It is the power of God for salvation to empty the hands of those who think they've got something so they come to him in faith alone and believe and trust in his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. Paul was not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God to rescue all who had come empty-handed. And we should not be ashamed of the gospel for the very same reason. For the very same reason. And the direct results, the implications of all of this, well, verse 14 to 15, that's the verse 16 begins with because for. The logic is that he's not ashamed of the gospel, and that's actually the backup why he's doing verses 14 and 15. I am under obligation both to Greeks and barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish, so I am eager to preach the gospel to you also in Rome. He's not ashamed of the gospel because that's why he's eager. He's eager to get on with gospeling. If you're not ashamed, you'll be eager. And that's the implication for us as a church, to be eager to share the gospel just like Paul was. And so we're moving to six implications for us as a church over this next year. Six ways that we're going to, I pray, under God, earth the reality of Romans chapter 1, verse 16. Number one, the gospel and Anglicanism. And you might think, well, why begin there? Well, at Christchurch Central, we are an Anglican church, but we are not in the structures of the Church of England. We're not in the Church of England. Why? Well, it comes down to this. We, as a folks who started this church, unashamedly, if I can use that word, chose to put the gospel priority over and above our denominational commitment. That's bottom line what we did. That's what we chose to do. There's a new bishop in Sheffield, and the new bishop of Sheffield, Stephen Croft, and myself have been in correspondence with one another. He wants to meet with me, and I want to meet with him. We are having breakfast together a week on Wednesday, on Remembrance Day, that is, on the 11th of the 11th. Please do pray for that. And how would I encourage you to pray for that? Would you pray that Stephen Croft and myself, that neither of us are ashamed of the gospel, that our conversation and our will and our hearts have gospel priorities, and that those gospel priorities for us both are more important than political, denominational or personal pressures? And by the gospel I mean, Paul's writing about the gospel through the whole book of Romans. There's ethical implications of it, moral, doctrinal. Pray that neither of us are ashamed of the gospel, and that takes a priority, and that we are both keen on the obedience of faith, verse 5 of chapter 1. And we want to see that in our own lives and in the lives of the ministries and the areas that we lead and have responsibility under God for. Gospel and Anglicanism. Secondly, the gospel and discipleship. Last year, the theme that I chose to give my kind of minister's report on was the first three verses of Acts chapter 13. If I was to ask you if you remembered that, I'd only end up feeling really disappointed that none of you can remember what I said last year. But really, the big theme was building up one another. Acts chapter 13 got a great picture of the church in Antioch and their leadership team and the way they're really passionate about growing. And they brought in the likes of Paul to join the teaching leadership team there. And it's a fabulous team, multicultural team of individuals leading that church. So I emphasized last year that we wanted to ratchet up our training and discipleship over this last year. We've more and more letting Pete Jackson loose with thinking through our training. And he's going to be carrying on doing that this next year. Last year, I gave a lot of time with women in the church to review and then implement a strategy for women's ministry and to ratchet up a discipleship amongst women. And as a result, Fiona Bronston is heading up our women's ministry. And so I want to say, well, not just tick the box, thank God. Thank God we've moved ahead with our discipleship amongst ourselves, with Pete and with Fee, and what they're doing, because it's not just up to them. Last year, I committed myself to giving time to reviewing my own ministry, my own work commitments, and to be thinking about the growth of men and men's ministry in our church, and leadership, eldership, and leadership within the church, leadership amongst men generally. So through the course of the year, came up with the idea of 12, our men's ministry, Christian discipleship for men, development of Christian leaders, training of Christchurch Central's next generation of members and leaders, to promote accountable friendship amongst men, to give me direct contact with men at the grassroots level of the church. I think that's really important as we grow in number. 12 men, 12 months, 12 times, looking at 12 areas of discipleship. We began yesterday, there are 18 of us. Say what? Someone said to me over the weekend away, a lot more room for a lot more Judases there. But we're ratcheting up the discipleship amongst men as we move forward. So that's the gospel and discipleship. But we don't want just to be ratcheting up our discipleship and ignoring that the church in Antioch that we were looking at last year was the first, if I can put it this way, church planting church in the New Testament. they took action to proactively set aside a couple of fellas to start going around the place and planting churches. Up until then, God had had to use persecution and all sorts of other things to keep shoving the disciples out because they weren't kind of doing what he'd said. Jesus said at the beginning of Acts, so they had to be pushed out by persecution. Well, here in Acts chapter 13, you've got the first church planting church. And yet they established themselves, they were being discipled and built up, but it was in order to keep on spreading the gospel. And so even as we go about our discipleship, we must not lose sight of not being ashamed of the gospel. We don't want to just become a church that's just looking after ourselves and not thinking about others. We want to continue to be a church for people who don't go to church. And then thirdly, the gospel and evangelism. I know those that will be in the know on language will know that I've basically used the same word there, the gospel and gospeling. And just forgive me for that. I couldn't think of any other way of putting it. Over this next year, we're going to be working on evangelism through the Passion for Life mission. We're joining with other churches across the UK, across Yorkshire, and in Sheffield to proclaim the message of Jesus. We're going to be doing that tangibly with Rotherham Evangelical Church, and the team will, I hope and pray, go to Rotherham and support them in their week of mission. A team of us will be going to Doncaster and helping Bessaker Evangelical Church with their mission. And the highlight for us will be March the 20th to the 28th, where we will have, as ourselves, a week of proclaiming the good news of the Lord Jesus Christ. We've booked Starbucks, as we hope to be booking Starbucks as we did earlier this year, and we'll be doing something on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday evenings, and then on the Friday evening, we'll have Frank Retief from South Africa, who in his church there, he had gunmen, terrorists come in one Sunday morning in the context of their church service and just open fire with AK-47s just after the children had gone to Club Central and the like. He pastored that church and had to care for people. And so on that Friday evening, he's going to be talking about why does God allow suffering. We've booked the Octagon Centre of the University, and Christchurch Fulham ourselves are kind of like spearheading that for Sheffield. And that's what we're going to be doing on the Friday. And then on the Sunday evening, Frank Retief will be preaching for us here at Christchurch Central. So that's to come. That's what we're going to be doing. And before then, we want our Gamma teams to do what it says on the tin. Gamma came from being gospel teams. To be about building up one another, but to be engaging with how do we as groups of friends reach our non-Christian friends. And Peter's set aside this actual week, this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, for us in our Gamma teams to be thinking practically how are we going to spend time with our non-Christian friends and how are we going to be praying for them so that when it comes to March, we can invite them to hear the gospel proclaimed. And of course, following on from that, we pray that some will want to be persuaded as they go on and do perhaps Christianity Explored. And that will remain a bedrock of our evangelism over this coming year. One thing I've done over this past year is get Duncan and Katie Rupi and James and Louise Viner and Katie Goodhart and Chris Pocock and Alex Cordell to be a new team leading Christianity Explored and to take some of that responsibility from me. And starts tomorrow night. So you may well be getting on the phone tonight. So actually, there's people that I want to be inviting now to that. So Passion for Life, Christianity Explored and Christmas. We don't want to miss out on Christmas. We've got a new thing that's being added to our Christmas evangelistic events this year. We run each year our carols in the winter gardens. Just a couple of weeks ago, Chris Bronsden and Fiona Bronsden went to a meeting of the Friends of Devonshire Quarter. Various people representing those that live in this area. Shops and the like, and there were the city ambassadors there representing the council, and as a result of that, the city ambassadors for this area have emailed us and they've invited us to run a carol service on Devonshire Green, just like we run in the winter gardens, which they know about because they're in charge of that too. So they've asked us to do the same thing. Now, that is to actually go and do some, not just sing carols, but have a service with a Christian message right there. We've been praying about that for some time. Now, so we wrote back and said, well, we'd rather not do that, thanks. No, we didn't. And I want you to put in your diary, otherwise it's going to be me and Chris Bronson, our own, with our big double-decker bus, you know. It's the 16th of December. And they actually said, look, do it midweek in extended shopping time. Do it around 7 o'clock while the shops are still open. And they've even said, they'll provide a gazebo. And if we provide mince pies and coffee, the council will reimburse us for the cost of the refreshments. So we said, doubly yes. Isn't that great? So 16th of December, put that in your diary. We're not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation of all who would believe. Come empty-handed. Pray about these things. Fourthly, church planting. This year we are, let's check the time, we are implementing a strategy towards another geographical church plant. We're going for it. Over the years, we have and we will continue to invest in the recruitment and in the training and in the deployment of associate ministers like Matt, like Pete, like Paul Robinson, and like Dave Crofts. This is not a case of jobs for the boys. All right? Not a case of jobs for the boys, but of the gospel for Sheffield. The gospel for Sheffield. Training men who can plant and lead churches. Bible teaching, church planting, evangelists. Like Matt, when he first came to join us, like Pete, who came to join us last year, Paul Robinson is willing to come and work for us for nothing. He's eager. Paul talks and uses the word eager in verse 15. Paul said, I am eager. Paul Robinson said, I'm eager to come. Karen said, I'm eager to come. No, we don't want to go anywhere else. We've got a heart for Sheffield, a heart for this church. And so we're just figuring out a way that maybe we can get some new money to help pay for that. And Paul's, that's kind of in Paul's bag at the moment of his responsibilities. So next summer, 2010, we hope and pray Paul and Karen and little Hannah, do you see little Hannah over the weekend? Did you coo her? We'll rejoin our leadership team on a part-time plus voluntary basis. And at the same time, in the summer of 2010, we will appoint one of our current ministers to be our next church planter. That's next summer, 2010. We aim to give that individual 1 year to pray and to find the location to plant in. And then 1 year to plan. And then in the autumn of 2012, 2 years' time, to plant a new church. In order for the new church to be sustainable, I'm hoping and praying that we will have increased the number of our unit givers financially. At the moment, I think it's probably in a region of around 60 to 90 or 100. So that the plant can leave with, say, 30 people who can give and support the work and make that sustainable so it can thrive and so it can grow. Okay? So that's the dream. That's the plan. Verse 8 to 15 of chapter 1 of Romans, Paul's talking about his plans, and I think it's right to have a plan. And so, fifthly, the gospel nurse. All of that I've said so far depends on every single one of us taking this responsibility. And it depends on every single one of us owning what Paul owned here. That is, I am not ashamed of the gospel and believing that it is the power of God for the salvation of all who believes. So, I mean, just as we're beginning to draw to a close now, just think of your friends. Think of the person, perhaps you've prayed for them for years. You know, 10, 11, 12 years, maybe you've prayed for them, maybe even longer. And for some reason or other, it might just seem impossible that they would ever come through to faith. Take that person in your mind's eye and hold that person's face in your mind's eye. And read verse 16 again. and claim it, believe it to be true. Pray, Lord, take me, use me, use your gospel to speak the words that come with power that will bring rescue, salvation to that person that you've got in your mind and your heart. And sixthly, pray. And that's what Paul is doing in this, the verses up to verse 6. He's talking about his plans, and they're steeped in prayer. Verse 10, always in my prayers, asking that somehow by God's will I may now at last succeed in coming to you. He's plot his plan, and he lays it all before God in prayer. It is good to set a vision before us. It is good to make a plan. It is good to set a target. But it's foolish not to pray, because God is sovereign. He rules over all. And so let's pray dependently upon God. And last year, I'm going to do it again this year, in December, as we run up to Christmas, I called for us as a church, and I sent out some instructions about it all. I called for us as a church to commit ourselves to a week of fasting and prayer. That's what the Antioch church did. They committed themselves. They were thinking about evangelism and church planting, and they got on their knees and they fasted and they prayed. And in answer, the Lord said, set aside Paul and Barnabas. And they said, well, no, we'd rather not set them. So they had some even more big prayers and fasting. It is them. And they sent off their best. So early December, we'll keep praying now, but we'll set a time to engage with that as well in December.